Yeah, good morning. It's Brad Spillane here. Spillo to the lads in front of us. It's the Men's Mental Health Show, and we're back for another week. And we welcome back Bodie today. Just before we kick into things and mention our guest, who's a local boy who's been on here a couple of times in the absence of the Boadster. Big thanks, of course, to all manufacturing personnel, recruitment and labour high in the manufacturing industry for all your staffing solutions. Give Craig a call, 0416 700 870. I just want to say a big shout out to a couple of people that have called me during the week. Dino, it's been good to chat to you, mate, and hearing your story. Another chap from Adelaide, just we're probably going to put together a couple or quite a large podcast which will hear the story of this chap. I won't say his name. He wants to sort of keep anonymous at this stage, but needless to say, it's a phenomenal story. I'll call him John from Adelaide. But I know he's listening, and just wanted to shout out and say, mate, it's been really good talking to you and listening to your story, and you know, albeit as hard as it's been, it's certainly been a journey. But let's move on to today's show. We've got Bluey here, who's thanks, mate, for filling in the absence of Boadster a couple of times when he was away for his sabbatical.
I think they're the best shows that have ever been put to air.
We almost need to put in the COVID screen here between the two of these boys. I was going to say, I've got the 13-year-olds in today and 70-year-old bodies. Good to see you, mate. Thanks. Thanks for helping out. And Boadster, mate, what a colossal, epic journey you've had over the past 8 weeks.
I have indeed. So for listeners, I've been in the UK or United Kingdom. It's not quite as united as Rishi Sunak might wish for, but had a wonderful time in the UK and a wonderful time in Ghent in Belgium and a wonderful time in various cities of the Netherlands. And I was there for visiting family and for dear friends of Annette, my wife, in the UK. And it just exceeded all expectations, the people that I met, the cities that I've visited, the people that I've spoken to, and I feel forever changed by this experience. I've been a little bit travel adverse, really, at some level, people would say. People are close to me, but thinking about men's mental health, I'd highly encourage people who haven't travelled a lot, you know, to take on board travel as a kind of an expansion of one's consciousness. It certainly left me as a permanent reality of a greater appreciation for the big world that we are and the people in it, and the similarities from country to country to country. We're all so similar and the same, and this nationalism that tends to feed conflict and wars, I just think, is a historic aspect of our past that as well needs to be dead, committed to the ground and buried forever, that we are more the same than difference that has been, you know, part of our conflict sort of heritage. So I've had a wonderful time. I ended up meeting cousins that I've never met at all, from, and I feel I've come back with about five brothers, additional brothers, that are part of my DNA. So, yeah, greatly expanded. To be back.
That was a highlight for me, I guess, in the messages that I got from yourself and Annette whilst you were away, not just the photos and the short videos, and you up there in the dance floor a few times with the 18, 20-year-olds, and was, I guess, the moments that you captured, sitting and being in the moment, and the appreciation and gratitude you had towards many, many things throughout that journey. I mean, you've got a very gifted way of words, let's say that. But, you know, and that was what stood out for me, I guess, was not just the appreciation of seeing these cousins that are obviously your DNA, but everywhere you went, it was astonishing to see, mate. So kudos, brother.
Yeah, look, I went out there to actually sort of feed myself, you know, and to be generous of my time. And I chatted to anybody and everybody who might have looked at me and sort of, you know, and something passed between us, and I go, how you doing? You know what I mean? I met this couple on a barge in a canal in Hebden, Hemden Heath, in the Yorkshire Pennines. And I walked over and said, how do you get one of these things, you know, these barges?
He said, just barge in and grab one.
He just barge. What he said to me is, we're part of 15 families and we all brought this together. Could never do it on our own. Right. And we come together three or four times a year to actually work out who's going to use it for what time and that sort of stuff. And then he said, you know, and I've been in cooperatives all my life. And I said, oh, I've understood cooperatives. I've worked with cooperatives as well. And we had this sort of intense conversation. And he's holding on to the rope, you know, and the barge is starting to swing out into the canal. And the wife says, you better stop this conversation, darling. So both of us are hauling the bloody barge back to the shoreline. But that was a sort of one description of how easeful it was to actually sort of catch up with people. And I love that. I love being expressive, but I love the way that was returned. And I had some excellent conversations with people all over the planet. And I thought, you know, there's something that's very intact. You know, we can get fooled by this whole idea that everything's falling apart. But there's another angle that's going on, which is also healing, and people are open for a new good story. Yeah. Absolutely open for that. And I felt that. I felt it in my bones that there's a well of good feeling out there which we haven't fully tapped in to create the new story.
And because we've been talking about the other side of that so many times, don't we? You know,
I think that's very true. Yeah, and you know, like you don't have to travel to get that. But I, you know, like Bertie, I drove my missus mad. You know, like we can be somewhere and I'll strike up a random conversation with just anyone. Yeah. And I always say to people, you know, when you come back from a trip, it might be interstate, it might be to another part of Sydney, it might be overseas. The thing that you remember is not a nice building or a nice bridge or a nice cathedral. You'll always remember human exchanges that you have in the most random of circumstances. And I think, like Bodie says, what travel does for me is it reminds me that, you know, people across the world, they don't have bloody, you know, two heads and six arms. Mm. You know, everybody's just like us and they're just trying to survive and get through life, you know, and... We're not that different. And for me, travel just gives you that sense that we're all here just trying to make a go of life and different countries, sometimes with different colour skin, sometimes with a different eye shape. But that those kind of differences, inverted commas, are highly superficial and we're all just human beings trying to make a crack at getting through this thing called life. And if you... Not everyone can do it, you know. A lot of people, even in, you know, my extended family, they see themselves and they are kind of unique on the planet in a sense. But if you look for opportunities to talk to people and relate to them, you get it back tenfold, you know. And I live my life. See, I believe that the world is full of great people that I just haven't met yet.
Yeah.
But if you believe that everyone in the world is a crook and everyone's out to get you, you will find 10 reasons a day to substantiate that view.
Absolutely.
But if you find that the world is full of really nice people and the occasional arsehole, giving people the benefit of the doubt, you'll find reasons to justify that stance as well.
Mm. And what is... I mean, I lived in London and in Scotland back in the mid-late 90s. What is it about... Because you went to a lot of major cities.
Yeah.
What is it about the further out you go... It seems to be the more time people have for you, or the generosity of giving their time and opening. Because you had a situation very similar to mine, where people opened their doors up to you because you couldn't get accommodation somewhere. Is that right?
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's What was the varieties like of city to city? Even was it? Did you notice the people very similar over in Holland and Belgium to say going up to Yorkshire with the pots and pans and being overly uncomfortable? What was it like out there, mate?
It was great. A couple that opened up the doors for us, you know, they were so big-hearted, and it reminded me of, you know, in New Zealand too, that idea of Māori hospitality.
Right.
And I think that's a kind of a universal value that we have historically. And you know, they're enormously valuable sort of cultural artifacts of meeting each other for the first time and being open, as Blues says so well. this is about men's mental health, and I keep on sort of reflecting back on the health of something. Mm. If you're going to hold a mindset of the world's against me, it's going to jump in and say, "Well, if that's your story, we'll fill that up for you."
Yeah. But if you'll get validation.
Yeah, but if you hold a sort of an openness to your experience and move outside of your usual go-to biases, and keep an open mind to something, that's where the light gets in, because you've cracked open the old bias and said, "I'm open to receive, and I want to receive good because I feel abundant today." You know, sort of using, and it's a postural thing. You've got to open your arms up and your heart up and
Put yourself out there.
Breathe deeply and put yourself out there, and people will tune in. When I was in this little pub in Devon, the lady, she was a beautiful, buxom woman of my age, and and I started flirting with her.
You should have seen some of the videos of him dancing, mate.
I started flirting with her, and she started flirting back, but it was conducted in the most beautiful way. And she was a woman who I instantly understood could size up a man in a flash and a look, and know exactly where you're worth something or not. You know what I mean? Yeah. That ancient woman wisdom of picking up something. And but we recognized each other's kindred souls, and we bantered. It was a funniest thing. And I had a great night. Annette was totally relaxed, and
good stuff.
We just enjoyed each other, and at one point I said to her, was this cream on the clotted cream on my pudding, did this come from Daisy the cow, who's won 4 shows in a row for butterfat milk content, and I guess it's been churned by an ancient wooden implement in your backyard? And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, "Cash and carry, my dear." And I thought, I've been outgunned by her, I mean, fantastic. And
nothing beats pure, raw honesty.
The town's too small for an Aldi.
You're an Australian. We can't outdo you in a yard.
She was probably attracted to Bodie because Bodie probably got longer hair anyway than her.
But, staying with that truth, it's about what's in your head as to what you're going to encounter in the world. And if your head is shut down, you're going to get a limited sort of kind of two-way traffic coming at you. And that'll just feed your narrative of the world's actually falling apart, or it's grim, or I have to be frightened, or I have to be full of fear.
Yeah,
those ancient narratives are part of our reality. But there is joy and awe and excitement and a pleasure of encounter, which are also sort of nuggets to actually exchange between all of us. Mm. And I've been thinking a lot about, men and women, and I've been thinking a lot about the tendency sometimes to get caught up in polarizations where we walk past each other as if you're a bit of the enemy, or you're a predator, or you're toxic, or you're out to cheat me of something, or whatever. And I think reading Yuval Harari's 21 Considerations for the Next Century, what occurred to me is that we need to find a language, a way back, men and women, to encounter each other. We really got to do that work. And we've got to do it from an expanded consciousness that allows us to put aside biases and stories that have horrified us and actually sort of be more open to, well, how can we rekindle a genuine regard for each other? And you know what I know, for guys who've got good marriages, their mental health is at optimum. Whereas with guys who are caught up in relationships, often through their own clumsiness, are hindered or stuck. They don't travel that well, and they don't have good health outcomes. The mental health that comes from reworking our relationships with each other between men and women, I think, is one of the most substantial health challenges in our lifetime and for the human race. I guess my plea to anybody listening here today is to rethink where you're at around establishing relationship between men and women, and making a better attempt at moving beyond our current distress and dis-ease and start to signal, I'm open for a talk, I'm open for a discussion, I'm open for listening, I'm open for reworking my template of ideas that have got a bit stuck, maybe because of my history as well. We can't remain trapped by our history and say all men or all women are unreliable and I have to keep on guard. That in the end will not deliver peace on earth or a feeling of contentment.
You're just going to get bitter and stay bitter. Yeah. And you'll find that even within your families and friends, they'll say, oh, you know, I used to mix with Spiller, but geez, he's getting bloody bitter and all bitter and twisted.
Look, we were just talking a moment ago.
And all of a sudden, you're that sad bloke drinking at the bar on your own. And, you know, every time I walk into a pub, because like Bodie, I like pubs as well, you walk into it, you walk into someone. If there's someone sad and lonely and bitter at a bar, there's generally a very good reason why that person's on their own.
Yeah.
Because I find even with good mates, if they start to turn that way and you can try and help them and try and steer them and give them a bit of advice and assistance, but generally I find that if someone's really got that anger and bitterness, they'll pull you down with them. And so then you start to withdraw from them. And they, you know, I often find that people who kind of want to go back to living under a rock and crying into their beer at the bar, society up to a point will kind of let them there, because in a harsh sense, they've earned that status, you know? And like everyone's got a story, and I'm not saying you walk into a pub and there's someone on their own. They might just have parked the car and had a prick of a day and thought, I'm going to have a couple of beers, you know? So I'm not, but I'm saying for someone who's, persistently on their own and chooses their own company, there's generally a very good reason why they've been abandoned and left in that state.
And there it is. I mean, look, you know, I've had four calls this week from different blokes across the country. And I guess one thing that I've... And they're all there to tell me their story. They're not interested in, say, myself or other people. And a lot of the time it sounds, you know, one chap, the John guy I'm talking to, and he says, I feel like I'm just complaining all the time. You may feel you've come across that way, but what about now? So what I did was, instead of not giving him the attention or paying or listening, I just let him speak. And the more he speaks, the more he comes across to understand his explanation and is able to work things out a lot better. So instead of us, if we see somebody, what I'm saying is we give them the benefit. If someone is angry or has, you know, other thoughts that aren't aligned with our positiveness, sometimes just give them a little bit of space and they can come around. There's often a reason as to why or what's behind that. So, you know, and in this man's case, he's been taken for everything he's ever earned and loved,
possibly,
you know.
but he's
developing further and further into the conversation, and he's actually a really lovely bloke. He's a top guy. And at first, I don't think he probably came across that way, but I just gave him some. And I think that is a great example too for some people that, you know, say family members or a close mate. We all of a sudden see, God, he's just been so negative. He's got some issues. Yeah. I'm like that when I'm not sleeping and I'm in pain, and I became quite negative and pessimistic but once I calm down, I guess, and I feel comfortable in that space again, my anxieties and the negativity have sort of dissipated. And
I think that's where a lot of organisations like the police and the fire brigade and the AMBOs and certainly the ADF, they have like an unofficial kind of buddy system.
Yeah.
And I think we've mentioned on the air a couple of times before, like if I know that, my mate Steve-O, for example, to pluck an example out of that well-known dark source, he normally goes home, he'll have a couple of stubbies, he'll fool around and, prune the roses and mow the lawn, that sort of stuff. But if you notice that all of a sudden he's having eight beers of a night, and he goes home and kicks the dog and has got no other... you might say, oh, I'm a bit worried about Steve-O, he's changing.
Yeah.
And then you might raise it with him, and then you'll find that there is an issue, and you might then be the prompt that stops him from going from two beers a night to eight beers to a dozen beers and then kicking the dog. And then, the missus has bloody cleaned out and the kids are gone.
Yeah.
Well, you might have been able to intervene quick enough and you say, Steve-O, you seem to be hitting the terps a bit more, mate. Anything you want to discuss? you can piss off. Yeah. You'll always get that answer the first time. You know, I just read this book, like, you know, Bodhi Newblock, so I'm an avid reader. And I was reading this book about a woman's attitude to a bloke that she was very keen on. But she made the interesting point. She says, you only ever asked that first question. And then, you know, we jump in the sack and we do the dance of the double back beast and he's happy with that. But, you know, I want him to go beyond that first question. Mm-hmm. You know, like, how are you? And then stop. And then they want to jump in the sack because he wants, you know, what some blokes want. And then she's wanting to ask the follow-up question and the question beyond that and the question beyond that and the question beyond that. You know what I mean? So in other words,
probably doesn't know how. That's
to go further than that shallow, oh, how are you? You know, because if you just ask a mate, how are you? You're going to get, oh, not bad, mate.
Yeah.
What does that tell you? 3/5 or 5/8 are not very much. But if you say, so, mate, I've noticed that you're going from 2 to 8 beers. What's going on with that? Yeah. Oh, you know, I don't really want to talk about it. Well, mate, I'm here whenever you do.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's all you can do as well. And then they just think, oh, you know.
Well, you find he's prepared to talk about these things after 4 beers, but
you know what? Yeah. You know what you asked me last week? Have you got a moment? And that's your chance to say, yeah, mate, yeah. And then, you know, you just chat because you've created that opportunistic space your own time and critically in your mate's own time for him to come back and say, well, you know, Blue and Bodie have actually asked me a genuine question and they've left me the space to come back and answer in my own time. As a matter of fact, I have got some stuff going on. Well, what is it, mate? What can we do to help you? You know, like, what's going on? Like, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved and all those buddy tied cliches. But you hear what I'm saying? If you, through the buddy system, if we all keep an eye on each other and we ask and respond, and we see it with people in all walks of life where people are just changing. And sometimes if you can, you know, without being obtrusive, you know, you just ask, you create that space for people to feel comfortable in and, you know, come back to you with a genuine response that may well turn someone around and say, well, you know what, I got a mate that does care. You know, before you know it, you might have, you know, intervene to stop them doing something stupid, either within the family or to themselves. And, you know, how do you know?
Yeah, well, it goes back to sort of Bodhi, you know. He's got the lock off the gate, hasn't he? You know, if people walk by, they sort of see the lock's open. Yeah, and he's this guy's happy to chat, you know. Mm. So he's putting himself out there, you know. And people warm. Some people warm to that. Some people sort of... Because I do it all the time.
Me too.
There wouldn't be a day that goes by where someone walks... When I'll start a conversation and they'll look at me as though I'm from bloody Jupiter. You know,
because you're a bit, like
why
you
would
say,
you ask that? You know,
especially from the inner city, especially from the town. This is what I love. I'm a great advocate for Australian poetry. You know, and like I know Bodie's into poetry, but I've got books on. You know, I've got a library on. You know, Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson and Kenneth Slesser and those sort of people. And one of the books I've got on Banjo says that, which I believe too. He writes about issues in a way that country people themselves would write and express their feelings and their humour if they were able to write like Banjo can, you know. And you asked that great point before about, you know, the difference between, you know, city folk and country folk. Mm. Well, you've only got to read and have a look at Clancy of the Overflow, and they shoulder one another in their rush and nervous haste. Mm-hmm. Because they have no time to waste, you know. And then he says, but I somehow rather fancy that I'd like to change with Clancy. Take my turn at seasons where the seasons come and go. Yeah. They just relax, you know. And if you ever stop and ask directions in the bush, you better have a couple of minutes available because you're going to get a whole lot more than just directions. You're going to get when it last rained, what the crop's like, you know. They just got time. They just got time to talk to you, you know.
Yeah.
In the city, people are, you know, head down. My mates and I, we just did a series of 2 bushwalks over, you know, the last week down south on the south coast, and you know, it's just sort of bushwalking law, LORE, that, you know, you pass the bush. Oh, where'd you come from, mate? Where'd you start? You know, where you camping? You know, where you're from? All that sort of stuff. And there was this one bloke that just ran past us, and he literally, you know, he had his phone out and he's looking at the watch. No human contact whatsoever, and just, you know, tore off through the bush, and you think, oh, well, you know, he's in his own headspace, good on him. You never know what people are carrying, but you just think, from a bushwalking perspective, half the benefit is lost just in that lack of exchange there.
You're not taking in the moment, you know.
It's almost verboten that you don't stop and chat. Oh, so, you know, like... Yeah, where'd you leave your last campsite, yeah, mate? You know, where are you headed tonight? And, you know, like,
yeah, it's something that I guess, you know, I've certainly noticed, and I've tried to put into practice, is just those small appreciation of gratitude towards things. You know, the appreciation of the warmth of the sun when it's 9 degrees outside, I'll stand over there for 10 minutes. What a difference that makes! It's honestly, it's like a difference between a jumper, a heater, and a gas fire altogether. You know,
definitely.
And I guess that when we're in a hurry, and we're on our way to work, and it's a fight to get on the seat of the bus, or you know, it's where's everyone going? You know,
One of the entertainers, one of the singers I really like, Daniela Caruana. She's married to John Butler, as in the John Butler Trio, and she markets herself as Mama Kin. And I, follow her on social media, and she put a post up yesterday where she says, which I thought was quite interesting. She says, she was photographed outside with her face turned up to the sun, and she said, how good is it, you know, when the, you know, early spring, you know, we're coming out of winter, coming into early spring, and you just want to go outside and you turn your face to get that flush of light and warmth. And she says, just have a think and reflect on who you've got as human beings in your life that provide that kind of warming light and growth to you. And I think that's a bloody interesting question, you know, like, it's that metaphorical, you know, you can see the sun shining through the window now to the, you know, to the due north. And, you know, being cooped up over summer, winter, some of us just want to go out there and turn our face to the light and the sun. Mm. And Mama Kin just asked, it's why she's such a good songwriter, I believe, you know, who in your life provides that same warmth and light that you can go out and metaphorically, you know, turn your face to the sun and absorb that light. I thought it was quite interesting. I'm alert to, you know, those sort of messages, if you like.
I think one of the things I'm picking up is this idea of what are the blocks, if you like, to actually sort of all of us having a better life or more empowered emotional life and a relational life with each other, with other men, with women. We've been sold a story, and the story is that we're all individuals, and there's no such thing as a society. There's no such thing as anybody else. You got to push and shove to get your bit of the planet in terms of resources. So you're on your own, and never forget, you're on your own. So we've been sold that story. It's a fiction because historically, we've always thrived better through cooperation and through collaboration and through villages and through connections. That's even our gene pool responds to others. When another speaks to us favourably, there's an immediate response in our body of a relaxation. The heart rate drops, the blood pressure drops. There's an oxytocin flush, which leaves you feeling sort of, I want to connect with this person.
Sure.
So our body's immediately responding to collaboration and connection. Mm. So the story we've been told, the fiction we've been told, is that we're all individuals, and you got to hustle. And there's no such thing as collaboration. So I think this to me is a lesson. That we men particularly have to sort of kind of grasp. And when we grasp it, men's mateship is a very fine thing. Mm. You know, we are wired to collaborate and to work together. Mm. That's abundantly evident in whole lots of fields. We've got to change this kind of mentality and pushback. There's a pushback against individualism and to increase our areas of contact. If you're disconnecting from the world, you're at risk of adverse mental health realities.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So you see that very much. You know, like a lot of human behaviour. You know, we think we're pretty smart and clever, but you watch. Animal behaviour as well. And
I was just thinking
One of the classic ways that, you know, a pride of lions or something will make it known is that they just ostracise a member of that tribe, or pride of lions, and that lion's gone, finished, dead, on its own. No assistance with hunting, no sharing of any, you know, responsibilities. And animals are very good at just ostracising a single animal, and that animal is doomed. And there's been lots of studies where that's actually happened. And, you know, like no man is an island, and, you know, on our own we are, you know, very, 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 very badly diminished. And, you know, like studies have shown that particularly with men, it's related to, like Bodhi says, you know, happiness and mental stability and, you know, longevity. You know, like you've got to be, you've got to be socially connected. You know, like my Mrs. Sharon and I find that, you know, sometimes when you've gone out and, you know, particularly when we, you know, we team up with her lot, you know, they're bloody Irish Catholics. They taught rabbits how to breed. And we'll go and mix with a whole mob of, you know, Sharon's clan, and we'll come back bloody knackered. Because, you know, the mental effort of maintaining yourself and contributing and responding and laughing and joking with large family and friends groups, it's intellectually stimulating and demanding. And, you know, you come home as if you'd bloody built the side of a church and laid 1,000 bricks. You know, you're as bloody tired as 10 tired things. But it just shows that that's so good for you, because it does take a lot out of us to contribute in a social atmosphere. But you know, like when you travel, or even when you're home, like you know, I'm going to walk home from here. I'm going to go down Katoomba Street, and I just know that I'm going to see someone, whether I know them or not, and I'm going to have a conversation with them about the most inane bloody things. And you know, it just like it's almost like saying, you know, we're all on this planet together. How are we going to make this work? You know, and I like Western Australian comedian Judith Lucy. She expresses it quite well. She says, "Now don't go hiding under a rock out there. We're all in this same shit sandwich.
She's a good thing.
We're just trying to make this stuff work." You know,
I often I've got a little Shih Tzu cross, and I'll take him up the shops, get a coffee. He's a great point of conversation. He's got a ponytail now. He looks like he's from Peking or something. You know, he's. Anyway.
Is it like Birdie and wears a pink bow on it?
No, mate. Yeah. He's very sensitive too, his Munster. You know, he's my father calls him the wombat. He's got a, you know,
because he eats roots and leaves.
Yeah, and he's got like, he's a nuts issue, but I won't go there. But I'll often, you know, sit outside of an afternoon. I might be having a tea, coffee or a cigarette or whatever. And I'll sit there and I think, I wonder, what's his day been like? You know, every person that walks past, he wants to say hello to. Albeit in his barking way. After he eats, he's always got to play. He's always got to put the ball in the blanket, and then you hide the ball in a blanket and he untangles it. When he comes back from a walk, because you take him for a walk to think he's going to be exhausted and he's not going to ask you because he constantly says, let's go. But he comes back even more energised. But it's just the abundance of energy and happiness from him when you give him some love or attention, more or less.
You
know, and we're no different.
That's right, exactly right.
We're no different. And if we do get ourselves hidden off or whatever else, some days I really do struggle to just go up there and get a coffee or stick him in the car or walk up the road. It's tough. It's tough. We talk about that with the men's table. I struggle to get there sometimes. You know, but when I'm there, there's never been a time where I've left there where I haven't been a better person or felt in a better state. And that's not from what I've given, but it's from what I've heard or from what I've listened to.
Yeah, very much. And you can be inspired by other people in that too.
And that's what I'm saying, yeah.
I'm
inspired by the dog. I'm inspired by other people's stories. I'm inspired by, you know, be them. That's right.
I was a pretty committed, you know, serious competitive distance runner, you know, I used to read Rob DiCostello and his coach Pat Cloese, and Deke used to famously say, when you've come back from a run, you look out the window and decide whether you should have gone. You see what I mean? So the wisdom in that is, you don't, will I go uptown, will I take the dog,
ask the question,
you go and do it. You go and do whatever it is, and that's just a metaphor for life, I think, for doing anything. And then when you've done it, you ask, it's a bit wet, it's a bit cold, maybe I shouldn't have gone out today, but it doesn't matter because you've already done it and it can't be taken off you, you know, and you just struggle through. Like, you know, I was saying that, you know, I heard cats, I must have, for sins in a past life, there's a lot of things I do, I organise people, like, and it's just advanced cat herding. And, you know, my three bushwalking mates, I love them to death, but sometimes, oh, I can't do that day, and I can't carry this, and I forgot my head torch, I forgot this and this. You just push through,
yeah,
and you put out a plan, and when you're actually on the track and you've got your pack on, all that stuff melts away,
yeah,
and there you are in the moment, yeah, you know. And mm-hmm, you don't get parachuted there. You've got to make an effort to get there, and there's all I used to describe when I ran Army Adventure Training like a big open funnel. And you tip in the bus times and what I'm carrying, and do I carry a Mars bar or a Kit Kat? Who gives two tuppenny shits? Doesn't matter. You just tip all that detail in, and then you get the pearls at the bottom. Like I say, when you've actually got that pack on, and you're in the scrub, you got the sunscreen on, you got the trekking pole, and you open yourselves up to the most magnificent views and experiences. But you've had to give something of yourself, and you've had to sit down in a pub like we do in Lawson or Springwood or Katoomba and come up with a plan and get our wives on side and get the diaries. So all that stuff gets tipped in the funnel. But the result, the end, is always, always, always worth it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's funny. We were having a coffee, the three of us, before we came here. And I noticed it a couple of times. Buddy's had COVID a couple of times. He got COVID over in the UK, the poor bugger. Anyway, you also had some of that respiratory thing, which was just horrible.
Vertigo.
But it was another one that you had about 4 months ago I imagine you'd be much the same, and because I am as well in many ways. But you know, you hear Bodie talk; he's just such a positive, you know, optimistic, but outgoing, and you know, energetic, and always doing something, keeping fit, and walking, and checking out things, and badminton, and everything.
Not when he partners with me on the court; I've got to carry him.
But then whenever you hear Bodie Crook, it's like, I was going to die. I had to call the doctor. I had to call the NHS in. And I was lying there. The world was spinning. I was throwing up. And you never hear him talk like that, except when he's probably not interacting with those other people. He's missing out on the euphoria or his medicine of that interaction. And he knows he can't do that. So there's probably a lot of that is the contributing factor towards you feeling like I'm going to die. And isn't that... Well, I mean, knowing we're not probably going to die, but
hard to
it's
maintain.
Like the end of the world. And so you think about that, right? When you get depressed, you fall further and further and further into that hole and distance yourself more and more and more through that isolation.
Yeah.
And the difficulty of
positive
coming out of
positive or negative reinforcement.
Yeah. Mm. And the difficulty of that coming out, it for some people, it's not as easy as saying, oh, I'll make the decision afterwards. It's like I've been throwing cold water on my face in the morning. It's bloody John and my mate Lockie. So I started off with the cold water. Now I start off with a cold shower. And every time I get in, I'm always cursing both of them. John with the cold water in the face or Lockie at the shower, you know. I'm cursing a mate's name when I get in the shower. But the difference that makes is, and I'm at the top of my breath and I'm just energized and I'm like, wow, you know, and then when that... It's a massive... And it's just those types of things have been a very big help for me getting out of that situation, you know. Like when the nurse
came in
the story, you got the nurse that came in and that was his way to recovery. She gave him an injection in the bum. I don't think it was the injection that helped make him recover. I think it was just the interaction of perhaps somebody that he's been able to talk to for the first time in 4 or 5 days, middle of his holiday.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to maintain.
You know what I mean? It's a massive medicine itself, isn't it?
It's a bit hard to maintain a conversation when you're just, you know, chucking carrot and rice all over the place.
Look, I think we're really picking up on that thread of what goes on in our heads, or how we become trapped by a feeling, particularly depression. I mean, it's a good example. And a similar one is anxiety, where it sort of becomes insistent that we start to think that this is all our world is now. You know, I've been consumed by my depression or my sadness or my anxieties. To extricate yourself out of a mood like that does require you to dig deep into, but what are my other stories?
Mm.
What what other feelings do I know about myself?
What can I do for myself to help?
What can I do to console myself? How can I help myself? Yeah. Who can I ring up to help me to sort of break the spell that I'm in? Because it is a little bit like an enchantment to fall under the spell of depression. And external world, our connections, our friendships, they are invaluable, you know, for actually helping us to restore an equanimity or a stillness a desire for living again.
Sometimes it can be hard, but you've really got to force yourself sometimes to get away from yourself or get out of your own head. Like, you know, you can go for a brisk walk or read a book that challenges you, you know. Read something that you wouldn't normally read, even if you don't agree with it. That mental stimulation just takes you away from being stuck in your own "oh, woe is me" head, you know, and sometimes that's hard. And again, that's where you know, mates can help as well, I think. Come on, mate, you know, you look a bit sad, let's go, you know, let's get on the badminton court, or let's go for a walk, or let's go for a run, or let's, you know, just do something, you know. Like, I remember, because, you know, when you said what we're going to talk about this week, I really like to talk about, you know, bouncing back and coming out of adversity and, you know, a bit of resilience, you know. Remember as kids we had those things that were like a big, large kind of balloon that had a weight on the base of them, and you'd punch this thing and it would bounce back up, and, you know, and you'd you know, give it a bit of a boot and ka-choing, it'd get back up. And I think we've got to see ourselves like that, you know. And we used to had these little toys as kids that you'd put your thumb up underneath and they had a spring kind of elastic on them.
Yeah, and you push them down
and they spring up underneath and go and just like collapse and, you know, be like a puppet, the joints.
Yeah.
And then you'd move your thumb and boing, they bounce back again. We got to see ourselves like that. And you think, what's going to be the thing that metaphorically takes that thumb away and makes me spring back up? Or if I'm that, you know, that... I don't know what they're called, that rubber sort of bouncing ball, punching baggy thing that we used to all play with as kids. They had little smiley coloured faces on them. What in my life is going to be the thing that stabilises me as that base weight, which is usually sand or something, and springs me back up? We don't want to be thinking, how can I fight gravity and, like this bouncing ball, stay down? How can I not be the thing with the thumb underneath it that makes everything all loose and floppy? What have I got in my life that's going to spring me back up? And like Bodhi was saying, is it a ring a mate? Is it go next door and see someone to, quote unquote, borrow a cup of sugar? Is it forcing yourself to do something you wouldn't otherwise do? Like, you know, join a bushwalking club, or just do something, you know, just do anything, you know. Like, I've had blokes, you know, like I went to a unit reunion, I never forget this, years and years ago, for the unit I was in Vietnam with. And there was a bloke over there who was an aircraft maintainer, an aircraft tradesman. And I thought over in Vietnam, it was a bit boring, actually. You know, he didn't have much to say. And anyway, so, you know, he did his job and he survived the tour and he came home. And I ran across him years and years and years later. And he's walking around with this a brag book full of photos. And he couldn't wait to show people what... He was the president of the Queensland bloody Hibiscus Society. Of all things, Queensland Hibiscus, you know, who gives a tuppenny stuff? But he would sit you down over a beer and he would say, "Mate, I developed this hybrid and there's three shots of it and this is it, you know, the morning light with the dew." And he was fascinating. And I got excited because he was so excited, you know. And I always say...
Well, you've shown an interest in him, and then a lot of blokes will share that interest.
I fed off his excitement and I learnt more than I ever needed to know and... forgot 99% of it within 8 seconds of the conversation. Yeah. But I fed off his enthusiasm, you know, and I often find, you know, you go to an army formal dinner and you're there for about 5 hours, and I can tell you, if you've got people on your left and right and across the table and you go, "Oh, yeah, oh, no, it's a bloody long night, mate." Mm. And so I used to try and find something that would make people's eyes shine. You know what I'm saying? Mm. You hit something, and in this bloke's case, it was growing hibiscus. And he was fascinated by it. And he took it on a Vietnam reunion. He's taken his grandma brag book of hibiscus. That was what fed his enthusiasm. And his eyes come alive, and 4 hours just disappeared. And like I say, oh, well, that's a nice one you've got near the front fence. What's that one?
Because it's an all too common story when a lot of blokes get together and we'll talk about our successes. You know, we've been talking about this with John in Bodie's absence. And, you know, we'll talk about our all these things that are materialistic, that have nothing but ego behind them. And you see a lot of men in conversations like that. I was with my cousin, Sacha. Very quiet, unassuming man. Very, very intelligent. And, you know, and here I was with my uncle, who's the original founders of Manuka Honey, and his Nobel Prize in pollen, whatever. And he's telling me all about his successes and his two young wives.
At the same time?
No, yeah, so he's got a young wife in Prague and another young wife, a Pakistan lady, which he calls he's got two telly bubbies.
He gets nagged in stereo.
So he's 72, and his wives are 23 and 26. And he's got three kids under the age of three. This is the bloke that catches wild boars without a gun. So he takes his dog and a knife and goes and catches 110 kilogram boars. I'll show you a video of it anyway. And we're there, we're just listening to this story, right? And there's Hutcho just sitting there taking it in for 3 or 4 hours, just taking it in and not, you know, contributing, or he's having a laugh and he's going to get the beers and... But his story was just remarkable, which he finally got a crack at around 10 o'clock. This is after my uncle passed away. An amazing story that he's fallen in love, married a Peruvian woman, and got sick and tired of being around her family and hearing them talking Portuguese. It's Portuguese, I'm pretty sure they speak. So he learned it. And now, he gets in the car when his wife picks us up and he's talking to fluent Portuguese. I'm like, how fantastic. And he's got this massive interest in her family. He's bringing them out now. They met in the UK and they lived together there. They bought a place, and then he went over to South America. I think they went to Chile or whatever they were living, and now he's come back here. And I think about it, wow, man, like what? That's an incredible story. And we were trying to get something out of this guy, and I guess I'm looking back at it and he just didn't want to compete with, you know, the private jets and, you know, the tennis players and the UFC fighters I'm sponsoring and all of these things. I can't catch wild balls. But he didn't sit there in judgment and say, I don't want to be with these blokes. He was having a chuckle and a laugh. He just bit his time, you know. And it was wonderful. And I look back at that and I think, God, I wish I had that sometimes, you know. I wish I had that skill. What are you going to say, Bates?
Well, I was going to say everybody has a story. Everybody has something that is incredibly valuable. I was talking to this young fellow. I mean, viewers might know that I am a psychotherapist, counsellor, and, so I have a number of people that come to me for various reasons. And what's interesting for me is this young guy has had some marital problems for the last 2 years, and it left him sort of feeling pretty wounded and difficult and challenged and all that sort of stuff. But a week before, I had said to him, what is it that you good at? How do you console yourself? He said, I used to write. Okay. So sitting in the room yesterday, he scrolled through his phone and he started to read what I call his wise part, says to him, and it was pure gold.
Right.
And he said, I've been astonished by how I forgot my gold. I got so trapped in feeling disgruntled and upset by my marriage failure that I failed to remember the wise part of me. That writes beautiful, honest, clear stuff that helps me to become the man that I am. Yeah. So it was a retrieval of parts of himself that had been given up because he'd been totally captured by his sorrow. And his disgruntlement and his anger and that sort of stuff. So
and limited to those two things.
Which
had taken full control of most of his thoughts, I imagine.
So what I keep actually sort of saying to listeners is if all you got in your emotional toolkit is mad, bad, and sad, you're in trouble.
Amen to that, man.
You've got to expand your emotional toolkit.
Yeah.
And there is many rich words in the English language that describe feeling states and emotional reality. And you've got to harvest a greater understanding of your emotional toolkit and regather all those elements of it and keep a good eye that you're not stuck in the one place, but have a much more expanded understanding of all of you and allow all those voices in you to have their time in the sun. You've got
And then a lot of blokes say, well, yeah, but that's all good and well, buddy, but how do I do that? You know,
look, that's spot on. I sometimes say, man, I can't tell you how to do that. That's your goddamn work. Why are you asking me that question? I'm just telling you the pathway. You've got to figure that out for yourself. Take responsibility for it.
But I think as I was saying earlier, and you're right, exactly. But the one thing, like from learning from yourself and John and Blue, is appreciation of the simple things in life are going to certainly be the first step in helping you learn that and getting out of that.
Absolutely.
Wow, what a great, you know, that bacon and eggs I made this morning, I made a bacon and eggs yesterday, but today it was better for some reason.
It doesn't have to
whatever
be much.
Whatever it is.
It doesn't have to be much.
And
to
that,
start.
And yeah. all these experts yeah. that I'm yeah. listening to, yeah. that I see, yeah. I get a million things that come through on my Facebook of mental health and through the page of the men's mental health. They've all got the one thing in common.
Yeah.
Practice gratitude first.
And it's... Yeah. Personal growth too, that can be a very slow incremental process. But I know plenty of blokes, because I spent my whole working life in the army, and in the ADF, like the police and the fire brigade, very very high marital breakup and divorce rates.
You know, like real estate agents.
Anyone like my missus who's stuck by me for my 50 years in the army. You know, it's a hard game to stay married.
She's getting a government grant though. That's
she should. She reckons she should get half my medals. But
I agree.
What I'm saying is, I know plenty of blokes who are on their second and third marriages, and then their wives that they might have left 15 years ago might return to their orbit as a friend, and they say, I can't believe the change in, let's say, Kevin, because he was a totally different man when I was married to him. And the blokes that I know and associated with will be the first to acknowledge that. You know, I was once talking to a running mate of mine who was the OC of a trial and proving wing at Mona Gita in Victoria, and they use it commercially too. The commercial companies like Ford and Holden will race their cars over this trial and proving ground at Mona Gita. And he was a great bloke, and he finished up running the South Australian, government bus line years later. But he was an infantry major, and I was a major as well. And he had this beautiful wife who was living out near us when we lived in just outside Melbourne in Victoria, and I couldn't believe that his first marriage broke up, because he just seemed such a nice bloke. You wouldn't think that there would be an issue that would have caused his first marriage to go belly up, and so I asked him about it over a beer one time. I said, mate, I just asked him that question direct. I said, what happened with your first wife? And I'll never forget this. The infantry cap badge that you wear on your beret or your slouch hat has a little motto underneath it with a little boomerang thing that reads, duty first. Mm. And he just pointed to that and he said, that's what happened. Yeah. So in other words, what we later fleshed out from that was that he was so army, and that was his world, his existence, and nothing else mattered, not his wife, not his kids. And so, the wife soon got sick of being, number three. Mm. And he learnt from that, and he changed. Mm-hmm. He needed to, and he finished up with this. You see that so often where someone's on their second or third wife or something, and they're just perfect. But it took a lot of growth and development, particularly for the bloke, I think, because, women are a lot smarter than us, always have been, for the bloke to change and re-emerge as a totally different person. Mm-hmm. And now I think they deserve that second or third wife, and they deserve that relationship. Mm-hmm. But they've had to go through a lot of blood, sweat, and a lot of tears to get there, and they are a better person for it. But like Bodhi was saying, it has to be them themselves. It has to be their solution to their problem. And in other words, if they can't see the problem, then they are the problem still. And they have to just... they have to just get past that. You know, like there's a great Kiwi writer, you know, who wrote Once Were Warriors and What Becomes of the Brokenhearted.
Pat Duff.
He's a great writer.
And I mentioned on the show Billions the other day.
He describes the central character in his, you know, second serious relationship. Yeah. And this woman is just treating him at arm's length until he reconciles to himself what happens to his... what happened to his first marriage and his children. And he, you know, we all know from Once Were Warriors that he built it to be Jesus out of it. And he never really got reconciled to admitting that he did that. And he was that sort of person.
There it is. Yeah.
And
he never got what?
He never faced up. He never admitted that he was doing that. And when and this woman wouldn't embrace him, like beyond the dance of the double back beast. But in terms of getting together under the one roof and going out and buying milk and bread together and doing boring, mundane couple things, she wasn't ready to take him on until he recognised in himself and reconciled to that, owned that behaviour and said, righto, now I'm moving forward as a new man. And she wasn't going to have a bar of him until he accepted that. And that is, I think, where a lot of blokes get...
So a couple of lessons that I've learned on that, right? And you know what my thoughts on that is. And I was that guy. Sometimes I still am that guy, right? Where, you know, I've got the bloody blinkers on. I can't see the forest through the trees because of the way of thinking is just, you know, so tubular-like. Anyway, I've learned a lesson a couple of times. No more so than a good mate of mine I've been working with where, you know, there's some things that are happening. I'm so bleeding obvious. This is what's going on. And so I confronted him head on with these issues and it backfired massively, right? So because I said, look, I'm the only one that's going to bloody tell you this. That's the thing, mate. You're not seeing it, you know? And it backfired and he didn't talk. And he got really up and rightfully so because of the way I spoke to him. Well, we were both talking to each other the same way, to be honest. But, you know, what we've got to do sometimes and you create, Blue said, creating that space is sometimes the most important thing for a bloke.
Sure.
Being a psychotherapist, you see this all the time, okay? You know, a lot of blokes want to come in and see you, say, how long is this going to take? How many sessions do I need? Can we just fix it in one?
Yes.
And we've talked about this a number of times, and it's quite often the case. All blokes will go to the GP and say, just give me an antidepressant, I'll get that to fix you. Well, it was a good thing on Four Corners last night. If anyone didn't see it, I'd implore you to watch it, including yourself, Bodes. But sometimes it can take two or three conversations with a mate that is so bloody obvious of how bloody wrong he is that he has... the only way that he's going to work that out is by himself. Mm-hmm. And just giving him that space to talk, mm-hmm. even though it makes you think, God, you should hear yourself. You should record... If you actually... sometimes it's how I think. I go, if you actually... and recorded yourself and played it back, you'd understand how much of a goose you are, right? But it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. It's never worked when I've said that or gone head on. Mm-hmm. But it has worked mm-hmm. when, and I guess, because I often do clash, I often do go head on. Mm. And it's been a really good settler for me mm-hmm. where I've gone... 3-hour, hour-and-a-half conversations with this bloke and I've calmed down and I've heard him say the same thing 5 times. It's the same story and I'm sure you've had a lot of your blokes that come in as patients or as mm-hmm. clients that are like, they tell you the same story over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But each time it's less. Each time, and then it's like halfway through that sentence they... I've said that before. Maybe I am sounding like I'm repeating myself. Mm. Hang on, maybe it sounds like I'm being the bloody... maybe it sounds like it's me that needs to change.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I extract from what you're saying is we've got to learn to create the space.
First and foremost, most importantly. Yeah.
Yeah. So after creating the space, what that means is suspend your desire to tell the other how to suck eggs,
or how to fix,
themselves, all that sort of stuff. So create the space, listen, allow them to actually unfold their narrative, because that's the only thing they've got. When you're depressed, or sad, or furious, there is no other narrative going on other than that's what's driving the mood or the stuck place that they're in. So you've got to allow them to actually sort of kind of unpack it. And you're right, successive unpacking can lead to them hearing out loud what they're saying, and there's a bit of a question comes up in their own mind that says, gee, I'm beginning to sound like a record, you know what I mean? And there is a movement there. There's an opportunity for you to come back and say, well, what else is possible other than the story that you keep advancing? You know, I think those things are sort of helpful interventions for a person then to start taking stock. The thing is that what we're really struggling with here about our mental health is somehow our fixation on maintaining the same old, same old. We avoid change, you know. I mean, it's the most frightening thing. And, I mean, that is historically true, that we are adverse to change. But adaptively, and your resilient story of the Tommy Tippy Man, Blue, is a classic example of that, that resilience coming back up again requires us to accept that what can I change? What am I open to as a new understanding that gives me traction back in the world again, that gets me to be able to come up again?
And this is what you're so good at, man, is when you see that change, you always create that pause. It's like, whoa, what does that feel like?
Hey,
where are we right now?
You've got to see...
So powerful.
You've got to see the significance of what you've just done for
yourself. 100%, man. You know what I mean? That in itself is powerful. But we create that space. But if we're prepared to create that space, we have to be prepared also to hear things as a listener, perhaps for a second or third time. That has to go around it. Because a lot of blokes need to work things out themselves. And you know, if we say, oh, geez, that guy's changed. But what a lot of us do is we go, oh, he's drinking every night. Oh, I don't want to talk to him. I won't speak to him when he's had a drink. And then we forget about him.
You're just going to entrench that behaviour.
They're all too common story. The amount of mates I had when I was married.
Yeah.
As soon as my marriage was over, I got no mates. None of them called me. Now, whether that's as much as his problem as it is his mates.
There's circumstances that really...
Yeah.
Cause you to learn who your mates really are.
And I've been saying for so many years, hey, your life is only going to change when you start taking responsibilities of your things. That is so true.
Yep.
But that's a massive, before you can get to that realisation, there is an enormous amount of work that needs to be done first.
And you need to own the consequences. And like Bodhi was saying, you can help people up to a point sometimes. Yeah. And you have to say, well, if you don't do something, you got to own the consequences. And it's like, you know, when you asked what we're going to talk about this week, I described that, you know, that metaphorical, like a road T-junction.
Yeah.
You know, you're driving down a road and you got no choice.
Yeah.
You're going to run into a whole mob of gum trees if you keep going. So you have to turn left or right. So you have to make a decision. Am I going to turn left?
Yeah.
Am I going to stay, you know, like Bodhi says, mad, bad and sad and angry?
Yeah.
And having turned left, don't go blaming other people for that.
Nah.
You've turned the wheel. You've moved left. You've chosen to go that way. You can go the other way and turn to the metaphorical right and say, well, now I'm in a new place and the sun's shining and the birds are singing and it's all wonderful. But what I get cranky about is when people won't accept their consequences of their behaviour and you think, well... How did you ever think any change was going to happen if you yourself don't own up to the fact that if you don't do something, you have to own the consequences for that? And don't go trying to take other people with you, because you've made a choice now, pal.
Yeah.
You're now living with your failure to move or failure to take the responsibility for what you've done. Suffer in your own jocks, mate.
Yeah, it can sometimes be the worst thing to say that to somebody directly. You know,
sometimes tough love, you know, like I was promoted to corporal in 1968 and I retired from the army in 2016. So I spent 48 years advising a lot of young men on how, you know, their you know, in terms of the impact of their career on the Army. Yeah. So I know a little bit about doing that in a very real sense with practical consequences. Yeah. But sometimes you do need a bit of tough love. And, yeah. You know, like I'm the first to, buddy, you know, bring people in for a, you know, like a bear hug. I'm a very kind of affectionate, you know, huggy type person. But sometimes you have to help someone to even get to the lowest point,
yeah.
So that they know that if they don't do something,
so how do you create that narrative?
They're going to stay there,
yeah.
Because so, you have to say, well, if you don't do something, mate, this is what's going to happen to you.
Exactly.
So you're going to be recognised as an alcoholic by the Army,
yeah.
And you will get kicked out if you don't do something.
You see the main reason behind why he is like that is because of his alcoholism. Then, and I can see that. I will often say, you know, when I was using substances and alcohol, how much that impacted. And at the time, it was a wonderful coping mechanism because I didn't have to worry or think about things that helped me numb.
Oh,
I didn't have to go through it. And it was a really good self-medication for me. But I tell you what, I didn't sleep and worry. I didn't become a normal person. I became numb. The anger, I didn't care if I got hurt. I didn't care if I died. You know, what? How bad is that? And then you go, before all of those behavioural patterns, you go, well, alcohol and substance is probably far worse than the behavioural patterns. Because the behavioural patterns are normal, but the alcohol and substance doesn't help you get out of those behavioural patterns.
If you want to see a real depiction of that, there's a brilliant series. Absolutely.
So it's being hard on the problem and softer on the person.
There's a Netflix series that's based on a true story called Painkiller.
Just seen it.
And it's just amazing. And, you know, that's a real depiction based on real life events.
Well, I had a
of what can happen if you don't get out of that rut.
It's tough. I mean, I've been coming off, I'm pretty much off them now, off the endo. It's for 18 months. It's been tough. Boys, thanks. I've really enjoyed the first show. There's been some good content, some good discussion and some passion, and it's been wonderful. Next week, I've got yourself and John, who I've been looking forward to having. Bluey did a show with John, and he's not backwards and coming forward, so he likes to say what he thinks, and he said the same about you, mate. He truly did. He said, I love the way he's set and way he is, and so it'll be a good show. That's John Milham, of course, and Bodie Marsden. If you want to give Bodie a call at some stage, you're more than welcome to. He doesn't mind me handing out his number, 0424 416 969, 0424 416 969, and that's Bodie Marsden, MSSAN.
Is it ARSCHOLE?
Anyway, listen, guys, I've got these blokes coming in. Thanks. I'll see you next week.